Okay, so this story is well familiar to you, and we know, of course, that the radius of both ABS5 and S5 becomes large in the, for strong coupling, so you can study this solution using supergravity. So supergravity becomes reliable. And then almost instantly, people realized that one can generalize this construction to what I call cone brains. Namely, instead of stacking these three brains just at some smooth point, you can stack them at the tip of some cone. For example, so the cone has to be Ricci flat. Then the base of the cone is an Einstein space, namely it satisfies Rij equals 4Gij. And then on the gravity part, the construction is completely analogous. One obtains the warp product of this cone metric with 3 plus 1 dimensional metric. And h of r, the warp factor, is again this 1 plus l to the 4 over little r to the 4. So in the throat, or r going to 0 limit, one finds ABS 5 cross x5, where x5 is the base of the cone. So there is a generalized cone brain conjecture that type the B theory on this background is dual to the infrared limit of the field theory on ND3 brains at this conical singularity. So here the gravity construction is easy, and the hard part is figuring out what the gauge theory is subjected to this extreme condition of being at the singularity. And by now, many examples have emerged. There are orbifold examples originally studied by Kaczor and Silverstein. I'll talk about the subject that I've been pursuing for several years, which is the case of the conifold, which is perhaps the simplest space that cannot be represented as just R6 modded by some discrete group. Are there any questions so far? Okay, so now I want to talk about the conifold case. And in this case, there has been very interesting progress that took place, I would say, over the last year. And then, if time permits, I will talk about the even newer cases of cones called cones over YPQ. So there is a whole new family of cones where one can apply the same construction. So this idea of just putting brains on cones is completely general. And at first, it's not totally clear what you're going to learn from this that's really new. But I hope to get across some generic features. For example, one that's rather naturally led, after adding some bells and whistles, to the notion of cascading renormalization group flows. And I'll show you what this means and how this works. So now the conifold is a way to describe a cone, a Calabi-Yau cone, in terms of four complex variables with this quadratic constraint. One can explicitly construct the metric in this cone form with the radial variable r. And on this base, which is commonly called T11, notation originally invented by Larry Romans, one finds this following explicit Einstein-Sasaki metric. So Einstein-Sasaki just means that it preserves one quarter of the supersymmetries, and that the cone over it is really a Calabi-Yau space. Okay, so now there are some important things about this space. One is that topologically, this space turns out to be a product of a two-sphere and a three-sphere, and this will be very important for us. Although the metric is written as an S1 bundle over product of two S2s, so the S1 is the psi angle, and the two S2s are here. And the bundle is contained in this shape. So now the conifold has some geometrical symmetries. One is the U1 R symmetry, where all the Z's are rotated by the same phase. And then there is also an SO4 symmetry that rotates the Z's, just the global SO4 symmetry. Okay, and all these symmetries will be important in the construction of the field theory. So when one puts the ND3 brains at the conifold, then, as I already said, the metric is very simple. And then the infrared limit, one finds AB as 5 plus Q11. Now the gauge theory, at first, it's not clear really how to construct it. And Witten and I first constructed it using an educated guess and provided some plausibility arguments. Then a kind of more systematic derivation was given by Morrison Plesser and other people. And in a nutshell, let me just say the result, you find SUN cross SUN gauge theory with bifundamental chiral superfields A1 and A2, which is in the fundamental of this group and antifundamental of this, and B1, B2 in the other conjugate bifundamental. And one needs the following quartic superpotential. Then the SO4 global symmetry just acts as SU2 cross SU2, where the first SU2 rotates these fields and the second SU2 rotates these fields. And then there are some additional symmetries. There is the U1R, under which the A's and the B's have same R charge 1/2. And then there is a baryon number symmetry, which rotates the assigns positive baryon number to these fields and negative baryon number to these fields. And there is also one particular discrete Z2 symmetry, which will be important for us later. Okay, so that's essentially construction of the field theory. And one can ask, this baryon number symmetry will be important for us. You can ask, how is it realized in the dual ADS-5 language? Well, it's not a geometric symmetry. It actually comes from the Ramon-Ramon sector. It comes from taking the Ramon-Ramon four-form field, taking three of its indices along the free sphere and the fourth index along ADS-5. So it's a symmetry that's not really obvious before just in the geometry of the conifold. For that, you really have to deal with the full string theory. And then there is a certain D2 which interchanges the A's and the B's and also charge conjugates each of the gauge groups. And this symmetry, from the point of view of T11, it interchanges the two spheres, theta 151 with theta 252, and basically flips all the freeform field strength, which is the SO2Z element of the type 2B string. And so this Z2 symmetry is realized and, of course, obeyed by the field theory. OK, so now onwards to more complicated things. Well, as I said, the T11 is topologically S2 cross S3. So one can, what one can do is one can add to the MB3 brains. You can add MB5 brains, which are wrapped over the two sphere near the tip of the cone. And then the theory stops being conformal. It undergoes some complicated RG flow. On the field theory side, the field theory changes from SUN plus SUN to SUN plus M plus SUN. On the string theory side, the change is manifested by adding M units of the three-form flux through the three-sphere, because wrapping defined brains over S2 creates some new topological flux. So one can try to pursue what happens on both sides and see what we find. And what we find is really a bit of a surprise, which was originally seen by Arkady Zeitlin and myself, which is that when you consider the back reaction of this three-form flux on the solution, you start seeing that the warp factor and other fields start undergoing some rather peculiar evolution as a function of the R, radius R. We know in ADS-CFT, the radius R is just the renormalization group scale. So this is just the explicit construction of the harmonic 2 and 3 forms. So you basically add the Ramon-Ramon flux proportional to this quantity and try to find the back reaction of the solution. Okay? And you find that the solution actually stays surprisingly simple. The dilaton is still constant. But the B2 field, namely the integral of the B2 over this two cycle, the two sphere, starts undergoing logarithmic evolution. And the warp factor is 1 over r to the 4 times also some log term. So what this means is very peculiar, since we interpret the pipeform field strength as a number of colors, you see that this number of colors starts logarithmically depending on the radius. And every time log r decreases by this quantity, n drops by m units. So it's a very peculiar solution. And at first, we weren't sure how to think about this. It was clear that somehow effective number of colors is decreasing. And then later on with Strassler, we realized that this should be thought of as a cascade of cyborg dualities. One other note for later is that you notice that this solution is actually has a naked singularity, because at some point this log will become exactly zero, and the whole transverse space shrinks to a point. So this particular solution is actually a singular solution, and you can call it the warped conifold solution, because the conifold is still intact and it's warped as a whole. And so one lesson that we'll learn later is that this naked singularity is really resolved by the complicated infrared dynamics that happens in this case, and the cone undergoes a geometric transition. Okay, so how do you think about the cascade of dualities? Well, if you just start, this is a kind of cartoon. I think the real story is somewhat more complicated. But if you start with the two gauge couplings equal, then you can see that one of them flows. This is 1 over g squared. It flows to a smaller value, which means that this coupling becomes strong and actually hits a pole after a finite amount of RG flow. Then one has to perform cyborg duality on this gauge group, and then the story repeats, because this, so now this gauge group changes from SUN plus M to SUN minus M, while this one stays SUN. So what happens is that at this point, the two groups get interchanged, and N goes to N minus M. Okay, and then the story repeats. This cascade, if you start with enormous N, say 10 to the 6 M plus P, you go through a million cascade steps before the cascade somehow reaches, stops, and something more complicated happens. So what this solution misses is the graceful exit from the cascade, but it certainly does incorporate the bulk of the cascade. So the question is, how do you see the graceful exit from the cascade?
What is the equation that the world has?
The equation? It's no longer, before the equation was just box H equals 0. Now the equation will be box H equals some F3 squared, because you have the extra flux that sources the box H. So all that happened is that H is no longer a harmonic function, but it's determined by more complicated equation. Yes, the solution is extremely simple in this approximation. It's just log r over r to the 4. And if I get to the end of my talk, I'll show you similar solutions for YPQs, which look very, very similar. So this log is really a sign of a cascade that happens uniformly. Okay? Because as you go through RT flow, you find that so you find that as log r decreases by some amount, n decreases by an amount proportional to log r. Okay, so it's the simplest kind of linear cascade. Okay, so this is all so far a review, and now soon I hope to get to the new and more juicy stuff. So now, just to finish the review, you have the, so now the onwards with the deformation or geometric transition, one finds that to get the graceful exit from the cascade, all one needs to do is to deform the cone. So you want to add to this equation epsilon squared on the right hand side. This, from the field theory point of view, is a dynamically generated confinement scale, or chiral symmetry breaking scale. This particular space is very famous. It's called the deformed manifold. And it's known that in this space, the free sphere remains of finite size. So the problem with the previous solution was that both the S3 and the S2 were shrinking to zero at the same rate. But since there is a flux through the S3, this flux really wants to prevent the free sphere from shrinking. And this results in the addition of this epsilon squared. And then Strassler and I made the guess that one should look for a solution as the warped deformed manifold, namely one takes the exact Calabi-geometric of this space, warped with the 3+1 dimensional space. And now the warp factor will satisfy some yet more complicated equation, which nevertheless can be solved. So now the lucky thing is that the Calabi-geometric of this smoothed out cone is known explicitly. I don't expect you to understand it instantly from these transparencies, but just to give you an idea, one writes down some angular one forms, and all which can be chosen in this basis, like you see basically the same type of standard one forms on spheres and so on. And the metric just involves some hyperbolic functions, cinches and cosches, and this type of funny thing with cinch. Sorry, this is cinch 2 tau minus 2 tau over cinch tau. So on. So the metric is not so bad, and it's completely explicit. And you see from this metric that the tau equal to 0, these two coordinates shrink to 0 size, and these three remain and actually give you a round free sphere left at the end, just as what we need to make this three-form flux happen. The M units of three-form flux prevent this sphere from shrinking. Then one finds that the warp factor is completely non-singular and monotonic. It's given by this type of integral. In fact, there is a first-order equation that you get for the warp factor. So the warp factor just starts at some value and then falls off as log r over r to the 4. And r is just e to the tau over 3 in terms of this new tau variable. And so we were, of course, quite excited because this gives you an explicit gravity dual of a confining supersymmetric field theory. The reason is you see it's confining is because h at tau equals 0 is non-zero. So a holographic calculation of Wilson loop, for example, gives the area law. And one can do various other things, like calculate the spectrum of blue balls in the theory and so on. This is more or less the state of our knowledge around the end of 2000. So we understood that there is some dual cascading theory. Then when n is a multiple of n, the theory, roughly speaking, cascades down to SUM. So people always said this is roughly like the gravity dual of pure m equal 1 SUM theory, which is naturally confining. Okay, but there are some subtleties that nevertheless were not completely understood. And these subtleties came to haunt us a bit later on. One other thing I want to say is that so what happens to various discrete symmetries of this theory? So the U1R symmetry, which is the sign of superconformal invariance, is just becomes anomalous, just like for n equal 1 gauge theory. The anomaly breaks it to Z2M. And then furthermore, in the infrared, this Bluino condensate, the appearance of epsilon, breaks it from Z2M down to Z2. The Z2 is just the simultaneous flip of all the Z coordinates. Right? Once you say that the sum of Z squared is epsilon squared, you only have the freedom to flip it by a minus sign. On the other hand, the SO4 global symmetry is unbroken, and there is still in the solution we found, there was still a Z2 symmetry, which interchanges basically the two spheres, theta 1 with theta 2. So the Z2 is preserved for the solution. And this corresponds to the fact that in the gauge theory, A's and B's can be interchanged. OK? So that's roughly speaking what happens in the infrared. But then comes the question that was sort of haunting us, or should have been haunting us for all these years, is what is the fate of the U1B, the baryon number symmetry? It certainly is not anomalous because the A's and B's have opposite charge. So the anomaly just cancels for this. But what happens in the infrared? Does this theory, how is the symmetry realized in the full deformed tunnel solution? So already in the paper with Strassler, we observed that it appears that it's broken in the infrared by expectation values of baryonic operators. So if one cascades down to, say, the SU2M plus SUM, which is really the smallest size you can honestly reach, then there is something remarkable about this theory in that one can write down baryonic completely Gaussian-invariant baryonic operators, which are also invariant under the SU2 plus SU2 global symmetry. These operators are, roughly speaking, the product of all the available A fields, or the product of all the available B fields. The reason it's so simple here is because as far as the SU2M gauge group goes, NF equals NC. And NF equals NC is the simplest case where you can have baryonic operators. And there, through the work of Zeiberg and others, one saw that there is this not this super potential with the Lagrange multiplier field, which either restricts you to the baryonic branch, where BB tilde is bounded to the 4M, or to the mesonic branch. And what Strassler and I realized is that we're probably on the mesonic branch, because on the baryonic branch, because on this branch, the S of 4 is unbroken, and the solution we have respected S of 4. The remarkable thing is that these operators are exactly invariant under S of 4. On the other hand, this branch, where you set B to 0, would break the SO4 symmetry. And that was essentially the argument for why we are probably on the baryonic branch. But then there was something left unexplained. What was left unexplained is if we're on the baryonic branch, which is this type of constraint, BB tilde lambda to the 4M, what happens to, so if U1B is broken spontaneously, why isn't there a Goldstone boson? Why isn't there a massless mode? And this question was asked in a paper by Aronyi, which was in turn basically written in extensive discussions with us. And we were basically arguing a lot about whether cascade makes sense and whether and what happens in the infrared. So I think eventually we convinced Aronyi that what we said made sense, but he still was bothered by the fact that there's no obvious Goldstone boson. Okay, so this was kind of left hanging for 4 years. And then there was a similar, seemingly unrelated puzzle, which is suppose we study the D string of tau equals 0, what is it in the gauge theory? We know that the fundamental string is just a confining string, but the D string has finite tension, and it was never completely clear what it was. I have to say, I started thinking about these strings again after I read the papers by Rob Myers, Joe Popchinski, and Copeland about various constructions of cognitive strings which involve the bottom of this warped road. And since, so that kind of reminded me that I never understood what this string really is. Okay. So then last year we started working harder at this with Steve Dobser and Chris Herzog. And the conjecture we arrived at is that there really should be a Goldstone boson. And then the D string is just dual to a solitonic string that couples to this Goldstone mode. Namely, it's just a global solitonic string of the field theory. So we set out to really look hard for the Goldstone boson of the U1B. And then you have to, the trouble with it is that you have to use a kind of trial and error method to look for it, because different supergravity fields mix with each other. And then eventually we found the zero mode. So in other words, we found that even though there is a discrete spectrum of blue balls, it starts from zero. There is no mass gap, strictly speaking. So we found a normalizable mode. And you see, the fact that these strain couples gives a very good hint for how to look for it, because the D strain puts in a perturbation on the F3, because its source is F3. And you know that this F3 should be star 4 of D of some pseudoscalar field A. Okay, so this gave the idea for how to write this term, and then we had to add other terms and make sure that the fluctuations are mixed. Eventually, we were successful, and this showed that there really is the Goldstone boson, which gives complete consistency with the picture that U1b is broken spontaneously. So you find that linear isoprogravity equation just requires d star d a equals 0, which means that this is just a harmonic equation for this massless mode. So that made us extremely happy.
So if you would,
yes.
Is it possible to show that there is no potential, and then you know, any quirky potential or anything like that to observe? See, this is a Boston mode. No, it should be massless. It should be.
Yes. Yeah, I think the super potential, of course, respects U1b, right? The super potential is ABAB, right? So this mode corresponds to rotating A by a phase and B by the opposite phase. So everything in the Lagrangian respects this U1b symmetry, but somehow these condensates develop, and they really, so I think it's purely spontaneously broken.
Right, so it's only possible interactions in the superiority side. It would have to be derivative interaction.
Yeah, and you can see that. You can see that. Because only derivatives enter in the undots to begin with. Okay. The remarkable thing is that the whole perturbation vanishes at zero momentum when A is zero. So, bingo, it's just pure derivative mode. It's a very peculiar mode. I think it's a would-be singleton, which in this case really comes alive because of these extra fluxes that we added. Okay, so that was, I think, so that changed my thinking about this, because that convinced me that the theory is not exactly pure blue SUM. It really should be thought of as SU2M cross SUM with this peculiar baryonic breaking in the infrared. Okay, so but this is just part of the story, because in a supersymmetric theory, we have to have also a scalar. So once there is a massless pseudoscalar, we know that we must have a massless scalar. From the point of view of the baryonic branch, it just means that there is a whole complex modulus zeta. Because the solution has this complex modulus. We're just fixing VB tilde, but this modulus has to be there. In particular, we should be able to rescale V by some overall factor and V tilde by the opposite factor. So far, we just found the pure phase mode, but now what about the radial mode? And so after some back and forth, we realized what it was. And it's also, nicely, it's a mode that breaks the Z2 symmetry, as it should be, because the Z2 interchanges B and B tilde. So also, after some work, we found that there is a mode mixing an S and S2 form and the metric. And this mode is really there. It's normalizable and so on. OK? So the interesting thing about this mode is that if you study the metric perturbation, the metric perturbation at large R behaves as 1 over R squared times some power of log times the difference between the metrics of the two S2s. Okay? And this type of thing actually studied with Witten back in 1999. And this is really what happens when you make a small resolution of the conical. Small resolution is something, is it in a motion and in Taylor space, which breaks the Z2 symmetry. And it signals a Viking expectation value for this type of Z2 asymmetric operator. And this operator has dimension 2, as you can see from the 1 over r squared dependence on ABS radius. Just to remind you, the solution is approximately ABS at large r up to logs, so you can use the usual logic of ABS CFT to read off expectation values of fields from the large r behavior. So that's why we sort of speculated that once we start breaking the Z2 and turning on the scalar zero mode, what we're dealing with is a rather peculiar beast. It should be called the resolved dwarf deformed conifold. And this is very surprising because everybody knows that when you just study Calabi-Yau spaces, there is no such thing as supersymmetric conifold, which is both resolved and deformed. That is impossible, right? You can either blow up. Once you have blown up the S3, that's it. You cannot further resolve it. But here, because of the presence of fluxes, you have these much richer structural solutions, and you should have these type of spaces. And what we found was that we just linearized motion in the direction of this special space.
What's the volume?
Excuse me?
What's the volume?
It's still the same. It's still S3. So S3 is blown up, but you're just breaking the Z2 symmetry between. So asymptotically, for example, you see this type of term. But it still has the same topology as deformed conifold, but you further break the Z2 symmetry. Yes?
So in the UDR saying that, that in order to get the geodesically complete space, I need some cycle to shrink to field size. Now here what we are talking about is resolved in deformed conifold.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that both S2 and S3 are blown up. All it means is that the Z2 symmetry is broken.
But still, in the geometry, there is a three cycle.
Yeah, there is a three cycle.
Or two cycles of three.
Just, yeah, two cycles still shrinks to zero. Three cycle remains, but it's still, I think this is a fair name.
It's just the Z2 symmetry, okay, from the perspective
of Z2 symmetry. Right. Yeah, so it's just, we call it resolved because it breaks the Z2 that is. Okay, thank you. So now another chapter in the struggle with these cone brains is the attempts to interpolate between the solution Strassler and I found and the Maldacena Nunez solution, which is another space with a free sphere at the end and some somewhat different behavior. So back in 2000, Papadopoulos and Seidman actually constructed an ansatz which, in general, preserves the SO4 but breaks the Z2. So in fact, it's sort of just what the doctor ordered if one looks for these more generalized solutions. And in fact, we realized with Gaussian Hertzog that our linearized solution precisely can be done using the ansatz. One of the methods we used was to extend this Papadopoulos statement ansatz around the Z2 symmetric point. And that's how we found the linearized perturbation. But then this still leaves the problem of finding the really juicy solutions where B is really not equal to B tilde, where the Z2 is strongly broken. And when I was giving the talk at Strings 2004 last year, I sort of said that, well, it still leaves this problem, which looks very complicated, but nevertheless, the field theory certainly indicates that the solution should be present because field theory tells us that there is a whole baryonic branch. But it certainly, you know, would seem like a very important thing to confirm the existence of these solutions. And amazingly, this was done, unfortunately not by me or my collaborators, but this was done by Buti, Grania, Minassian, Petrini, and Zaffaroni in a paper that appeared last December. And actually, I recall during the coffee break after my talk at Strings, Minassian came up to me and said, I will look into this. Because they had these fancy methods of SP3 structures, and they essentially pushed these methods through for the Papadopoulos statement ansatz and derive first-order equations for functions which appear in the ansatz. So now you're getting truly into complicated stuff, because this is really very complicated. I mean, I'm pretty sure I couldn't have done it in the next term. I was working on it with a student, but one really needs to use these fancy modern methods. Even after you write down these equations, you cannot solve them analytically, but you can try to numerically integrate them and develop expansions. And the work in this paper, and also the work I've been doing with my student Demarski, it confirms that these solutions are precisely the duals of the baryonic branch. Namely, what they are is that far at large tau, they approach exactly the cascading asymptotics, the same asymptotics that Seidlin and I had back in 2000. But their behavior is very near the infrared, is different from the behavior that Strasser and I found. It's really, it can be viewed as interpolating behavior between the KS and MN cases. And this is truly amazing. I think it really explains a lot about this whole structure that people have been working on for years. In fact, this solution has a parameter that they call zeta. Actually, they called it C, but I interchanged zeta and C in my talk. But this parameter ranges from 1/6 to 1/2. At 1/2, the Z2 is restored, and you just get the KS solution. At 1/6, something really interesting happens, which I want to comment on. Okay, so this is what I said, that there is a Z2. And if one perturbs near the C equal 1/2, one recovers the analytic zero mode that we found with Gopser and Herzog at order 1/2 minus C. If one continues perturbing at order 1/2 minus C squared, one finds that all other fields pick up corrections. And in particular, the dilaton starts varying. The dilaton starts varying in such a way that the coupling actually gets weaker as one goes into small tau. And one finds that this variation is actually proportional to the KS warp factor. But there is one thing that doesn't change, amazingly enough, which is F3. It's roughly F3 sort of measures the complex structure. So all these solutions have the same complex structure, but they have different geometry and different background fields and so on. So they're really complicated solutions, but they do have this just the right structure to be dual to the baryonic branch. There is one analytic relation between the warp factor e to the minus 4a and the dilaton. And what happens, you can tell what happens when C approaches the extreme of value 1/6. What happens is that, so as you start at the Z2 symmetric solution, phi is totally flat. Then, keeping phi asymptotic value fixed, it starts dipping down, down, down. So phi naught gets more and more negative. As C approaches 1/6, phi naught hits minus infinity. Okay? And that's a sudden singular point. So you can basically tell that phi naught hits minus infinity precisely at the end point. What does it mean? Well, what it means is that if you keep phi here fixed, you actually find the curvature singularity because the size of this free sphere, while originally large, so the size of the free sphere measured in string units is g string n times e to the phi naught times some very smooth function of c, which actually this at c equal 1/6 just approaches 1. You can tell that if you keep this factor fixed and this hits 0, then this whole S3 shrinks to 0 size. And this is what happens if you push very far to the extreme along this baryonic branch. This is not too surprising because the baryonic branch, when you go to extreme, it corresponds to either sending b or b tilde to infinity, which should be somewhat singular, okay? However, the following amazing thing happens, and this is something that couldn't have been anticipated without the solution, which is if g string m, say, is extremely large, then you can make this zeta very, very close to 1/6. And you're still keeping supergravity valid because this quantity is still pretty large. Then you can see that for very large range of tau, from 0 to some large value, the solution is arbitrarily good approximation to the MN solution. But it starts to deviate from it appreciably for tau bigger than the cutoff value because the dilaton levels off. If you remember, the MN solution has linear dilaton. And linear dilaton kind of causes problems. But here, the dilaton just levels off. So I would call this the MN solution with a UV regulator. So it's an MN solution which in the UV starts cascading again. And I think these solutions are a lot easier to work with than the linear dilaton version of the solution. So now with my students who are trying to study more precisely what goes on, but it's truly remarkable that you can sort of get arbitrarily close to the MN solution in the infrared by pushing along this baryonic branch. And the full significance of this is still unclear. Okay, so I already told you, I think, a lot. I still have a bit of time. So I want to give just are there any questions? I probably went too fast, but I know that many of you have heard bits of this story before, so. Any questions?
Yes? Just sort of a detailed question. That zeta, is it real or complex? They find that one complex
variable? Yeah, zeta is real. And I think what happens, this is another thing we're trying to confirm now. What happens is that if you remember how our pseudoscalar solution worked, it wasn't visible at zero momentum. One had to work at non-zero momentum. So even at, say, zeta equal to 1/2, one had to do something a bit more complicated to see the Goldstone boson. One had to do this other perturbation. Okay? So I think the same thing happens here. So exactly at zero momentum, a phase rotation of BNB tilde can be kind of gauged away. And that's exactly what happened at the Z2-symmetric point. You can gauge away the zero momentum stuff. So at zero momentum, you just see the real direction. To see the Goldstone boson, which we're pretty sure must be there, is turning out quite complicated because the fields mix even more, but I'm trying to sort it out now with my students. In other words, we think that there is an analog of our pseudoscalar mode which has to be built with more care when zeta is not 1/2. We already know what it is for zeta equal to 1/2. But that's a very, very good question, and indeed it is. But that's how this works. So in other words, you can always rotate the field so that the B and B field are real. And that's like a gauge freedom here. But this doesn't mean that there's no other zero mode, and you have to see it. You just have to work at non-zero momentum. Any more questions? Okay, so just to conclude from all this, so we see very strong evidence for the existence of resolved word deformed manifolds, which are supergravity duals of a certain moduli space of confining gauge theories, where you actually have confinement without mass gap, just like in PCD with massless quarks. But the origin is rather complicated. It's related to expectation values of baryonic operators in this particular field theory. I think it's pretty remarkable that supergravity is capable of describing continuous chiral symmetry breaking and confinement without mass gap. And also, more recently, the seemingly different solutions appear to be tied into the same, essentially same moduli space. And I think we can learn more from this stuff. I mean, there are immediately more questions once I study. Okay, now I call my talk Home Brains Revisited because In fact, one other thing that's been happening is the emergence of many more. So all of this referred to the conifold, which is the simplest, in a way, non-trivial foam brain example. And after all these years of work, we more or less understand what happens in the infrared and all this complexity. But now there are new examples of collabial foams, which have been called YPQ by Gauntlet, Martelli, Sparks, and Waldron, who discovered them about a year ago. So I obviously can't do justice to discussing this because it's in itself can take a talk. But I know Martelli, who was in Princeton last week, is coming here, so you can probably ask him for more details. So I just want to give a flavor for what this is. I mean, essentially, they obtain completely explicit examples of co-metrics. But these metrics, again, are somewhat complicated, and it takes days of staring at them to sort of figure out precisely what they mean. For all P and Q, you can write them in terms of the basis of one forms. And then there is a special angle Y, which will play a big role in our discussion, because there is no symmetry under Y translation. These spaces are not completely. T11 was a completely symmetric space, but these spaces are not. And we'll see some very interesting Y dependence of the solution that emerges. So now the metric involves some funny kind of ratios of polynomials in Y. But it works for all P and Q ranging from 0 to P. And I want to just give some hint of what the meaning of these spaces is. So the Y is restricted to lying the range between two of the smaller zeros of this qubit, which have explicit expression in terms of P and Q. And so these metrics have been lying around for close to a year, but I think increased interest in them was sparked by a recent work by Benvenuti, Franco, Hanani, Martelli, Sparks in November, where they actually constructed the quiver gauge theory dual to these three brains on these cones, much like what Witten and I did for the much simpler conifold case. Okay, and so these gauge theories in general have two PSUM gauge groups. And one important subtlety is that they are somewhat less symmetric than T11. So we again have U1R and U1Z, but instead of SU2 cross SU2, we only have SU2 cross T1. And this plays a big role somehow in these series. So when these people constructed the quivers, they managed to calculate the anomaly A coefficient using another recent development, which is the Trilligator Rect A maximization method. To obtain an amazing result, they found that the field theoretic anomaly exactly matches the anomaly calculated holographically from the exactly known volume of YPQ. And this is the kind of reason for some of the excitement about these spaces. So these are, again, dualities. So this is a whole large new body of examples of foam brain dualities. And one can think of them as sitting in the window between T11 mod ZP and S5 mod Z2 mod ZP. Because it turns out that for Q equal to 0, the space that we find is really T11 mod ZP. So for Q small, much smaller than P, the metric is close to this. And for Q very near P, the metric is very close to this orbit fold metric. And we already knew from long ago that the flow from S5 mod C2 to T11 is a kind of interesting example of holographic RGB flow. Okay, so now this is just, so one can do a lot of fun things already with the conformal gauge theory, with just the DS-CFT. But we can also play the game with extra wrapped D5 brains, just like we did for the conifold, because the topology of all these spaces is just a product of S2 process 3. So we can do exactly the same thing as before. We can just wrap the defined grains over S2 and the apex of the cone, break and formal invariance this way, and again, see if we can study both sets of the duality. And this was the subject of my recent paper with Chris Herzog, Kuzia, and Jones at the very end of last year. And we found basically the analog of the so-called KT solution, where we don't deform the cone, but just, so it's a warped cone solution. And the ingredients in that solution is to find the 2,1 harmonic form, which corresponds to the fluxes of the G3 and H3, just as we had in the statement, and then plug it and solve for the warp factor. There is some new complication in this case because this two-sphere harmonic form omega actually depends on Y explicitly. And this is really because the space is not as homogeneous, is not a homogeneous space. Nevertheless, you can immediately see that V2 again grows as log r times omega, which again means that you have a logarithmic cascade. So Fy again just starts, the number of colors cascades down as the theory flows to the infrared. And one thing that we are fairly proud of is we were able to solve for the warp factor. Now in this case, it's a quite non-trivial log because of the extra y dependence, we really arrive at a PDE in two variables. And generically, this will not have a solution unless one is lucky, but somehow the solution does exist and it's smooth on the basis, completely smooth, just given in terms of very simple objects like logs and 1 over 1 minus y. And then there is this factor log r over r naught. So if you look at fixed y and go into decreasing r, you always find a naked singularity, just like we did with the prime column before we knew how to smooth it out. But there is still a lot of use to this solution because it describes arbitrarily well what goes on at large r. So this describes, again, this big escape, because you can just see that the phi form, because of this stuff here, again, the phi form, which measures the number of colors, starts, as you come in, it starts logarithmically decreasing. So all these examples have cascades in them. These cascades are generically much more complicated than what we had. What? Let me just, it's on my next transparency. I'll try to, I basically don't know, I mean, but I'll say it. So what happens in the gauge theory? Well, let me give you an example of the, say, YPQ quiver. From the point of view of YPQs, what we were doing with conifolds seems like now like very easy stuff because for the conifold quiver just looks like this. There is SUN here, SUN plus N, two arrows this way corresponding to the A's and two arrows this way corresponding to B's. And then what happens is that this flows to stronger coupling, you realize in this becomes N minus N, then this flows, and this flows, and so on. Okay, and this is what I already explained. Okay, now in YPQ, it's much more complicated. So here, but it's very beautiful. I think it's really amazing how these examples actually realize some similar principle, because here is a quiver for Y43, okay? It has one so-called impurity because it's very regular as you go around this quiver diagram. And what you find is SUN plus 8M, SUN plus 7M, SUN plus 6M, SUN plus 5M, SUN plus 4M, SUN plus 3M, SUN plus 2M, SUN plus M. And there is this impurity connecting the smallest and the biggest group. Okay? And then what happens is that as you you can show that this group lost the strong coupling first. When this happens, this H group turns into SUN. Okay? And then when you play with this, when you implement the cyber-geology correctly, what you find is that the whole quiver goes into itself, except with N replaced by N minus N. What happens is that this impurity starts kind of jumping around the diagram, okay, and starts circling around, much like it did here. But here it's much more obvious because it has a lot more room to run around. But the whole quiver is completely self-similar in the cyber duality. And this is, you know, if you just try to think it out, it won't be very easy that the whole field theory under cyber duality goes into itself, but with N decreased by M units. So it's a very special class of these quivers. And this, I think, more or less confirms the idea that the cascade is possible, because this N is just going, these flows will start happening with N jumping down. And this more or less corresponds to what we found in the supergravity. Okay? So that's pretty amazing, but there is still a lot we don't know. For example, so one thing you see is that for N over M being an integer, incidentally, the quivers are the simplest for SUP, P minus 1, because there is a single impurity. For generic case, there are lots of impurities. They can collide and do some crazy things. Anyways, I would be happy to understand well what happens for P, P minus 1 case. But as I said, this is all very sketchy, and I don't want to give you way too much. I'm sure you'll hear other talks on this subject. So what you see is that when N over M is an integer, you eventually cascade down to the following infrared gauge group, which is just SUM, SU2M, up to SU2PM. And this is the analog of what we found for the Carnifold, where we only had these two. Now, for the Carnifold, life was fairly easy, because then SU2M flows to strong coupling, kind of confines, then next SUM confines. And you're just left with this leftover Goldstone boson of what happens with the global symmetry. Here, I haven't worked hard enough to figure out what goes on. Here, there is a much bigger range of possibilities. Okay, and so basically, the infrared dynamics is not fully clear yet, although recently there were interesting papers by Hanani Franco Hanani Oranga, and then more recently by Oranga and collaborators, which study these generalized type of cascades. And just their idea is that what if, actually it's the idea that already Strassler expressed long ago, and then Strassler and I, what if you just think of this as the standard model, of some kind of analog of standard model? Suppose you end up with SUM cross SU2M cross SU3M, you get something similar to standard model at the bottom of the cascade, then maybe this is a way to build some kind of novel model building. And just last week there was a paper by Ranga who I think added a lot more kind of substance to this idea. It's a long and complicated paper, so I haven't fully understood what goes on in the infrared yet. But hopefully, maybe after I read it, I'll tell you the answer. But I think, you know, it's certainly an interesting idea. So basically, what we still don't understand about these examples is all this elaborate story of the deformation of the singularity. Because, for example, I suspect that it's possible to just geometrically deform it just like the Carnifold got deformed, and you get just a smooth space with some extra maybe Goldstone bosons. But this problem has not been solved even without fluxes. Because essentially the complication here is that instead of just one radial dependence, you have dependence on the radius and this angle y. But I don't see just generally why it shouldn't be possible. And And we were certainly quite lucky with solving for the work factor, even though it does depend on these two variables. So I think these whole sort of zoo of examples gives some hope that these are really generic phenomena for cone grains. So one can probably learn a lot more from these generalized theories. I think I'll stop here.
Questions. I just want to say yes.